from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. A new investigation by Mother Jones Magazine finds that plastics free of the controversial additive bisphenol A, BPA, may actually be more harmful to humans than those containing it. Meanwhile, scientists continue to debate what doses of the chemical are harmful, and we'll discuss the latest news on the controversy over plastics and why the plastics industry has fought hard to protect these chemical additives from regulation. That's coming up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Last summer, the FDA banned the use of bisphenol A, that's BPA, in baby bottles and infant cups, but continued standing behind its safety in other products. Among other uses, BPA is in bottles, soda cans, food containers, and many other consumer goods to harden plastics and to prevent the growth of germs. In September, the FDA rejected a ban on BPA in plastics, saying more study is necessary. Concerns over BPA led to the development of a new generation of BPA-free plastics. But now, according to a recent investigation by Mother Jones Magazine, these new products contain possibly harmful synthetic estrogens. For over a decade, the controversy has endured over the safety of BPA to the world's food supply and its possible role in a wide variety of public health problems. And in this morning's opening forum hour, we want to discuss bisphenol A, BPA, and its substitutes. And joining us is Mariah Blake. She's with us from the nation's capital. She's a reporter for Mother Jones who did the story that I alluded to in Mother Jones. And welcome, Mariah Blake. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
We're glad to have you. Also glad to have Dr. Linda Birnbaum with us. She is a director, we'll have her shortly, National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and National Toxicology Program. Meg Schwartzman is with us. Dr. Schwartzman is a research scientist with the Center for Occupational and Environmental Health at UC Berkeley and associate director of the Berkeley Center for Green Chemistry. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
And Meg Schwartzman is here with us in studio. Also with us by phone this morning, Justin Teagarden, senior research scientist in exposure science and toxicology with the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Washington State. He's worked on a number of studies of BPA. Justin Teagarden, good to have you on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And let me begin with Mariah Blake, just so we can lay out some of what comes out in your article, Mariah Blake. The fact is that the FDA has said that BPA in low doses is not to be concerned about. But some of the—I want to get into that with you, of course. But you talk in your article about lack of responsiveness to synthetic estrogen, to what's been used in place of BPA. What are the concerns there?
Well, and the concerns about BPA-free plastics, this is relatively new. So around 2008, the public grew very concerned about BPA, and the plastics industry began introducing a variety of BPA-free plastics.
I'm sorry. We lost the connection there, and we're going to try to get back, obviously, with Mariah Blake. Let me go to you, Meg Schwartzman. The plastics industry, according to her article, has tried to discredit BPA links to health problems, and you actually have had some experience along those lines, you've said?
I have. I published what I thought was a fairly innocuous article in 2008, an editorial in the American Family Physician. It's a journal that's only read by family physicians. I would think of it as a fairly backwater journal. But nevertheless, it seemed to attract the attention of scientists who were making the argument that you often read from in industry promotional material, sort of disputing the science that I had laid out about endocrine disruptors in general, with BPA as a specific example. And that engendered a couple of letters to the editor in response. And I was offered the opportunity to respond to the letter to the editor. And when I did, I revealed the conflicts of interest that the writers had. So these were people who had previously testified against the, for example, the effects of passive smoke exposure on kids. So there's sort of a history of testifying for industries benefit. And when I exposed that information, the journal didn't end up publishing either the editor, the letter to the editor, or my response.
Well, I should mention that Stan Glantz, who is leading researcher on secondhand smoke, has put a dog in this fight, so to speak, and says that the campaign is similar to that of the tobacco industry. And that's pointed out in Mariah Blake's article. But Mariah Blake, let's get back to these substitutes. We lost the connection with you, these synthetic estrogens, these substitutes for BPA. I mean, are these possibly more harmful?
Well, some of them are more estrogenic. So the problem with many of these chemicals is that they mimic the hormone estrogen. And so the degree of response varies from chemical to chemical, and some of these chemicals actually stimulate a greater response in the endocrine system than BPA does.
Okay, I'm not trying to conflate synthetic estrogens with BPA. I'm just trying to get to the point that these products were essentially produced because of the rulings on BPA, were they not?
Well, what happened in many cases is the industry just used other kinds of plastics that were already on the market and that hadn't been, the chemicals that were in them had not been as thoroughly tested as BPA. In a few cases, there were new plastics that were brought to market that were specifically designed to be free of BPA-like chemicals, so chemicals that mimic the hormone estrogen. Triton, which I focus on in my piece, is one of those products.
Actually, we have a statement from Triton, and I'd like to get your response to it. We invited a representative of Eastman Chemical Company, which makes the BPA-free plastic Triton, and they declined our invitation, but they did send us this statement. It says, Eastman stands behind its products to ensure the safety of Triton. We use testing methods regarded as gold standards by the scientific community. In fact, we've gone above and beyond government and industry testing requirements. Independent third-party labs tested Triton and have proven that it is free of estrogenic activity. Plastipure and Certachem companies, which test products for chemicals that act like estrogen, use a single, non-definitive screening test called the MCF-7 test. It is widely accepted and acknowledged that this test is usually considered an initial screening test and has not been validated by the National Toxicology Program's Interagency Coordinating Committee on the Validation of Alternative Methods and the U.S. EPA for use in its Endocrine Disruptor Screening Program for the purpose of identifying substances with estrogenic activity. We should add, by the way, that estrogen is certainly not free from all kinds of things, or synthetic estrogens. It's used, I believe, in a birth control pill, isn't it?
That is correct. That is correct. Well, so I would actually like to let Dr. Birnbaum comment on the MCS-7 portion, so the test that Bittner used. But I can talk about specifically about Eastman's testing method. So they claim that their testing was done by independent third-party laboratories. That is completely untrue. They paid for this. This was something that they attempted to cover up. They lied to their customers and told
I think
it was not, and that is very clearly spelled out in documents that became public as a result of a lawsuit. So the other thing to understand is that, in fact, some of their own testing found that Triton, this product, was potentially estrogenic. The first test that they performed was a computer modeling test, and that computer modeling test found that one of Triton's ingredients was, it's a chemical called TPP, it's a plasticizer, was potentially more estrogenic than BPA.
But as they say, and this is just the chemical company again putting out its statement, they say here, in fact, let me bring Linda Birnbaum into this. Linda Birnbaum is director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and the National Toxicology Program. And Eastman puts out a statement which says, statements that all plastic display estrogenic activity are simply not true. Eastman Triton does not display estrogenic activity, as supported by the science and testing presented on our safety testing. Dr. Birnbaum, do I have you?
Yes, you do. Hello, Michael.
Yeah, hi.
So I think the issue is that what the testing has been done by, for example, Certachem and Plastipure and some of the other the companies indicates that there's the potential for many of these compounds to be estrogenic as measured by an in vitro cell-based assay. I know of little testing of any of these other compounds that have actually been done in an animal study. which I think would be we probably need in order to confirm that what we see in an in vitro test is in fact going to happen in the whole animal.
We get into, though, this kind of complicated science. In fact, some think that the FDA kind of took an attitude it did about prohibiting baby cups and things of that sort because of all of the pressure when there really wasn't enough data on the doses. And in fact, a lot of these epidemiological studies are very difficult to really crunch down in terms of saying there is harm or there isn't harm. Isn't that sort of what we're dealing with here, Linda Birnbaum?
I don't think it's that simple. I think the issue is that the epidemiology studies, which are really quite recent, before the late, before, say, 2006, 2007, 2010, nobody was looking in human populations for adverse effects of BPA or some of the other related chemicals. Now that they've begun to look, we're seeing more and more associations in many well-conducted epidemiology studies that can't prove cause and effect, but can say the BPA levels in a person appear to be associated with a variety of health endpoints. And the interesting thing is almost all of those things we're seeing in the human population, there are animal studies that support that contention. So there's a biological plausibility to the argument.
Well, let me go back to Meg Schwartzman on this. I mean, a lot of this evidence that comes from biometrics or biomonitoring, I should say, in bodies and suggesting harm, in fact, from BPA. There are many factors that have to be drawn into even conclude anything about causation.
It's true. as scientists, what we try to do is sort of connect the dots of the evidence. Like Dr. Birnbaum was saying, we take the evidence that we see from cell-based tests and see if that mechanism corresponds to what you see in tissues in animals in the lab. And then if you can see there's a correspondence with something you observe in people, that's sort of an evidentiary kind of set of stepping stones, and you can connect the dots and start to make conclusions. But it's very hard to ever get definitive proof of cause and effect. And for that reason, I think as scientists, we also have to be honest about what the questions that science can't answer. And think about, if we do get complete clarity about the science on BPA, what then? The industry has already moved on to substitutes, and then we have to undertake the testing of each of those substitutes in great detail individually.
And the FDA claims that they don't necessarily have all the personnel and the resources. I've heard that cry on this program. And by the way, we invited the FDA to participate in this morning's program, I should mention. And Linda Birnbaum, you have suggested, I think, that we do have cause for concern where BPA in developing embryos and longitudinal studies with young girls. Can you spell some of that out for us?
Well, I think both the Chapel Hill Consensus Statement, which was a group of scientists who were pulled together by our extramural program in about 2006, who concluded there was some cause for concern, and then the National Toxicology Program conducted an evaluation and concluded that there was some cause for concern, especially related to developmental effects on the developing nervous system and on the developing prostate. Those findings led the FDA to issue their statement that they had some concern about the potential health effects of FDA. And that basically led to a marketplace response, which eventually led to the ban of BPA in baby bottles and sippy cups. I think what NIEHS and NTP have been trying to do over these past 4 to 5 years is actually enhance the database and try to get at the understanding of really what are the kinds of effects that we see both in mechanistic cell-based systems, in animal studies, and in people. We are currently conducting a very large study that the NTP is funding FDA to do called the Clarity Study, which is following all the required good laboratory practice requirements and the guideline studies. But we're supplementing it with many more animals and many more dose levels. And we funded through our extramural grants program, competitively funded, over 11 different research groups to ask the questions about what BPA may be doing that are not traditionally asked in a guideline study. So these are very complicated but very well-conducted studies. the FDA, the animals are exposed during gestation, so we are getting that developmental exposure, and they're exposed for the rest of their life up until 2 years of age. And the animals, the study will end this summer. In the meantime, there have been interim sacrifices where animals have been removed at postnatal day one and at weaning and at 90 days of age and at 1 year of age. And the investigators from the different grants are getting either actually the animals or pieces of the animals, or in some cases they actually went down to the FDA lab in Jefferson, Arkansas, so that they could actually run functional assays like measuring behavior, which you obviously can't do with just having a brain. You need the whole animal, or, for example, measuring certain other functions that have to be measured in the living animal. Mm-hmm. Now, the data from that is not going to be available. I expect that we might see some data starting to become available within a year, but this is a completely blinded study, so all the investigators don't know, you know, was this, which dose of BPA were these animals exposed to?
Well, we should mention here that the American Chemistry Council finds it is very unlikely that BPA could cause health effects at any realistic level. They put out a statement, which I'm not going to read. Read too much, perhaps, of the last statement. But let me bring Justin Teagarden into this. He's a senior research scientist in exposure science and toxicology with the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Washington State, and he's worked on a number of studies of BPA. And unlikely that BPA could cause health effects at any realistic level, Justin Teagarden?
Well, I'm not going to make a statement directly about risk because that's beyond my purvey. But I want to make a couple of points here, and I will touch on the question that you asked, I promise. The first point I want to make is that any one individual scientist or journalist or individual scientist-journalist, our efforts to kind of connect the dots, as one of the speakers described on this issue of health risks associated with BPA or any other compound, are very difficult to compare to the kind of very transparent, very systematic and objective reviews that the regulatory agencies do, where all the evidence is together weighed by large groups of scientists across the very many different scientific domains that are required to put the pieces together to understand the difference between a material that is estrogenic in vitro and may pose, at that level, appear to pose a hazard to one that actually poses a risk in the human population, which is what we're concerned about here, at the kinds of exposures that people experience. And so my work has touched on this issue over the last 5 years, funded by the US EPA through a STAR grant. We have essentially delved into this question of what are human exposure levels of BPA, and in particular, we look at...
Forgive me, you've been looking mainly at plastic bottles and food containers, haven't you?
Correct, for BPA.
Yeah, right.
And we essentially fed people a diet very rich in BPA, which we could establish by how much came out in the urine. And we effectively found none of the active compound in the blood at levels, at exposure levels that were many four times higher than human exposure levels by all estimates that have been done to date. So from that information, it's pretty safe to conclude, if that's correct for the human population, that the levels that cause effects in animal studies consistently in well-controlled studies are much higher by thousands than the levels that people have in blood, that is the bioactive levels of the compound. This is the gold standard. This is the way we deal with drug safety and drug toxicity as well. So I leave it up to the regulatory agencies to make that call, and in fact, they have. The European Food Safety Authority has just come out with their assessment of BPA.
Also, the World Health Organization, and we should mention Japan's National Institute of Advanced Industrial
Correct.
Science and Technology, they've all taken a position that the risks are too low.
That is correct. So there is a consistency that we see in the conclusions by the regulatory agencies that convene panels of experts and conduct transparent, systematic, and very objective reviews, which is what we have to rely on so that we can overcome the limitations of any one of us, and that includes me as well.
Well, let me bring Mariah Blake into this. And Mariah Blake, some would say maybe there's some anti-science hysteria in this, and you would say what to that?
Anti-science hysteria, I would say exactly the opposite. Well, first of all, I would urge listeners to read the article by my colleague Tom Philpott on Justin Teagarden's study, which has not been published or peer-reviewed. And I think the science on BPA is very clear. So there has been
an, wait, let me just get
hold
on a second. I want to get Justin Teagarden's response.
I just want to make a correction of fact. Those studies, every single one of them, have been fully published and fully peer reviewed.
Okay. The one that you because there's a study that you, your own research at Northwest National Laboratory, Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, my understanding is that study was not published or peer-reviewed.
So it is very common scientific practice for research scientists, including those that are funded by NIHS, to go to scientific meetings and present material in the form of abstracts, and then they are published short time after that. So Phil's article caught this work in between the original expression at a scientific meeting in abstract form and final publication. So as I said, all those papers are fully peer-reviewed and published now.
Okay. Well, there are more than 1,000 peer-reviewed studies that show that BPA causes health effects at low doses in animals or cell culture tests. There are now more than 90 epidemiological studies on humans that show that there are these kinds of effects. In 2002, 12 prominent scientists in the field conducted a literature review and found substantial evidence that endocrine-disrupting chemicals generally harm human health.
So why is nearly every agency worldwide saying there's not enough evidence?
Well, in the case of the FDA, I mean, let's just look at the FDA, for example. In October 2008, it came to light that the FDA was relying on industry lobbyists to assess the risks of FDA, and that basically, the two studies it relied on most were these two industry-funded studies, one of which was fatally flawed. Now, if you look at the science, the research conducted by academic scientists almost universally finds effects at low doses. The research conducted by industry-funded scientists, not a single industry-funded study has found these effects. Now, when you look at the study designs of these industry-funded studies, there are certain elements of their design that make it very unlikely that these effects will be found. And one of them, for example, they commonly use this kind of rat called the Charles River Sprague Dolly rat. Now, this rat is insensitive to estrogen. It can, according to one Japanese study, withstand levels of estrogen 100 times higher than a human female without any response. So you are essentially testing estrogenic chemicals on an animal that does not respond to estrogen.
So this is Justin. I'd like, if I could, to take a moment to respond to some of these facts, because I think these are very important issues. The first one, I want to agree with you that if exposures in the animals and cells were causing effects at doses that were equivalent to human exposures, I, as a toxicologist and somebody concerned about public health, would fully agree with you that there is an issue there. And so you've used the term low dose many, many times, and this is something that's propagated throughout the scientific community as well as in the media. But I think the challenge you have is that you're not sure what that term means. It implies to you and everyone who's listening that the exposures in the animals are consistent with human exposure. But let me tell you the truth. You can actually read this in a paper that we published, which is a very transparent, very complete, systematic, and highly objective review of the use of that word and what it means.
Justin Teagarden, let me ask you to hold it there, because we're coming up on a break, and the break doesn't stop for anyone. It's a hard break, but I also want to invite our listeners to join us. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement in the program, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about a new investigation by Mother Jones Magazine, which focuses on BPA-free plastics linked to adverse human health effects, and it finds that plastics free of the controversial additive, BPA, may actually do harm to humans. And also, scientists are continuing to debate what doses of the chemical are harmful, and we're trying to sort of get to the heart of that as well. And we're discussing latest news on the controversy over plastics and why the plastics industry has fought fairly hard to protect chemical additives from regulation. Our guests include Dr. Meg Schwarzman, who's here with us in studio, research scientist with the Center for Occupational and Environmental Health at UC Berkeley and associate director of the Berkeley Center for Green Chemistry, and Dr. Linda Birnbaum, director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and the National Toxicology Program, Mariah Blake, who did the article on this in Mother Jones, that is, on the BPA-free plastics, is with us as well. And so is Justin Teagarden, who is senior research scientist in exposure science and toxicology with the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Washington. He's worked on a number of studies on BPA, that is, bisphenol A. And you are welcome to join the conversation. In fact, we cordially invite you to do so if you have something you'd like to contribute and add to the conversation, or if you have questions or comments, our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And I want to go to your calls and emails, but first I want to flesh out this whole notion of dosage. And Justin Teagarden, before we went to the break, was really addressing that. Could you finish your thoughts or complete your thoughts?
Sure. So the upshot of this review that we did is that it became very clear that the term low dose is used to describe doses that cover 10 to 12 orders of magnitude, a billion. So it's not a term that describes any doses, and it is clearly not a term that describes doses that are relevant to human health at all or human exposure. The most famous of the most highly cited of the low-dose studies, to which I'm sure you refer, only 1% of the studies in that review were conducted in animals at levels that are equivalent to human exposures. The rest were dramatically higher. So this is simply the truth, and I think one of the challenges that we all face is the selective citation part.
Let him finish his thought here. I think, have you finished?
And finally, just on the rat issue with the sensitivity to estrogen, that argument has been fully, discredited by careful dissection of the science and the literature that's out there. And most recently, the 90-day study conducted by FDA showed that, in fact, that strain of rat was, in fact, sensitive both to BPA at high doses and to estrogen because the controls were run side by side.
Excuse me, Justin. The NCTR Sprague Dawley rat is not the Charles River Sprague Dawley rat. And I think people need to understand
Linda Birnbaum speaking. But Mariah Blake, you wanted in here too. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to address Justin Teagarden's comments about the relevance to human doses. We are talking about doses that are relevant to human exposure. So in November 2006, Linda Birnbaum's agency, the National Institute of Environmental Health Scientists, convened a group of 38 leading researchers from various disciplines. They evaluated what were then the 700-plus existing studies on low-dose BPA exposure. And they later issued a consensus statement that found that 95% of people in developed countries were exposed to levels of BPA that are within the range associated with health problems in animals.
I saw that consensus statement, and actually I'd like Linda Birnbaum to have you address what we're getting to in doses here, because I didn't want to read a whole statement from the American Chemical Council on BPA, but they do say, we just heard from Mariah Blake about a consensus statement in your group, and the American Chemistry Council says, and I'm reading here, many government bodies around the world have evaluated the scientific evidence on BPA and have declared it safe as used in food contact materials. For example, U.S. FDA in June of 2013 responded to the question, is BPA safe, with one unambiguous word, yes. FDA recently released the results of a comprehensive subchronic toxicity study, one of the largest studies ever conducted on BPA, and the results were published in the peer-reviewed scientific literature a few weeks ago.
Okay, so I do want to talk about the issue of dose, and I also want to talk about those subchronic studies. So the issue of dose, I couldn't agree more with Justin Teagarden, that most people don't define what they mean by low dose. And there are basically two definitions, and one is that low dose is any dose below where no effects have been seen in the standard guideline animal testing studies. And by that definition, a lot of these 1,000 animal or cell-based studies are done at a low dose. However, that's not the definition that other people use, which is a dose that includes levels to which the average person is exposed. So in other words, general population exposure. And that is much, much lower than many of these animal studies. However, there are a number of animal studies that are being done now which are either at the range of general human exposure or at the high end of the range of human exposure. If you actually measure the total amount of BPA that a person could consume in a 24-hour period, and the way you do that is by you measure what comes out of their body in a 24-hour period, because BPA doesn't stay long in your body, what you find is there's a pretty wide range. While the average level is quite low, there are some people that are 20 to even 100 times higher than that average. And those people may be people we need to know more about.
Well, I want to bring our callers into this, although Meg Schwarzman, we're down a rabbit hole here, aren't we, in terms of the complexity of the science? Yeah,
well, I think that what we're witnessing here is reflects some of the legacy of the Toxic Substances Control Act. So our current chemicals regulation is built in a way that assumes chemicals are safe until proven otherwise, and that places the burden of proof on the public to prove otherwise, and that then sets a standard of evidence that is so high that it leads to this kind of dueling science.
We call this predictive toxicology, right?
That's not predictive toxicology. I don't know, Michael, if we have a time to talk about that or not, but the predictive toxicology would be the development of new and more current opportunities to predict in advance what the effects might be in people by doing high-throughput, short-term kinds of studies or using alternative animal models.
Well, I was using that language because I think there are those, and I think Meg Schwarzman, I don't want to speak for you, but are critical of the Toxic Substance Control Act as being ineffectual. But I did want to get our callers involved in this, and Lauren has a question, I think, probably for you, Meg. Go ahead, Lauren.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. This new research and your dialogue, I should add, is fascinating and obviously very important. But as a consumer and expectant mother, what should I be doing in light of it? Which products do you recommend? Should I stick to glass, like the BKR water bottle? And what brands do you advise us to use at this point?
Yeah, Meg Schwarzman.
Yeah, well, I think there is one way of sidestepping the dueling science, which is sort of to opt out. And in some ways, we can't opt out because we can't control what's in our food and water and our environment. And the EPA reported that 1 million pounds of BPA is released into the environment every year. But there are some choices that we can make that can help control our exposure. And that has to do not with selecting maybe the safest plastic, but going for another material entirely. So using glass containers, using unlined stainless containers, not eating canned food, not taking paper receipts, which are also very heavy in BPA or its substitutes, are some simple actions. And there was actually a study recently in 2011 of 5 Bay Area families that completely replaced their food source for 3 days and saw on average their urinary BPA levels drop by 60% with the removal of all plastic contact materials and canned foods from their diet. So there is something that the average consumer, and especially a pregnant woman like the caller, might want to do.
And thank you, Lauren, for the call. And I want to get to another caller here. That's Micheline. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had 2 boys before BPA was taken out of the plastic baby bottles. So 12 and 13 years ago, and when I hear about BPA and plastic, I just wonder what my concern should be about my boys having used that for all their baby formula, you know, before BPA was taken out of the plastic bottles.
What would you say her concerns ought to be, Justin Teagarden?
I don't feel that I can answer that question directly, and I'm not sure it's appropriate for me to do so. But what I would say is that I would, as I've said before, put some trust not in individual scientists or journalists or journalist scientists, but a little bit more of your faith into the large regulatory bodies that do these systematic reviews. So if you are to believe them, then perhaps there's nothing to worry about. But you have to make those decisions on your own.
Well, there's a listener here, and Mariah Blake, let me go to you on this, who says the category BPA-free covers a wide swath. In particular, where BPA has been replaced, are there differential rates of effects depending on what replaces it?
That's a really good question, and I think the answer is we don't know.
Yeah, it's Linda Burbaum.
You know, right now we kind of have a chemical conveyor belt where concerns are raised about a given chemical, and that chemical might be removed from the product and a substitute is put in, but we know less about that substitute. And I think that's part of the problem that we're dealing with, is that chemicals aren't tested before they're adequately tested before they're put into production.
Here's a maybe related question for you, Linda Birnbaum. Cooper asks, please ask if there is a test my doctor can order that will measure these synthetic estrogenic compounds in our bodies, and are there any methods of removing them from my body?
So the answer is that for many of these synthetic estrogens, they have very short half-lives in your body, which means that they leave your body very, very quickly. So there are tests that could be done to measure specific estrogens, for example, coming out in your urine. And there are tests that could be done, certain tests that could be measure the total estrogenic load as measured, for example, in your blood or your urine. But they are research tests. They're not routine laboratory tests that your doctor could order.
And another listener asked, what about biodegradable utensils? They are bendable like plastic but are made out of something else. Are these safe? Want to come in here?
I can weigh in on this because this actually plays into things that I was reporting on. So the biodegradable, they actually are plastics. They are corn-based plastics. And so CertiChem and Plastipure, together with a professor at Georgetown University, tested 455 commercially available plastics for estrogenic activity using their cell-based test, which Linda Birnbaum has spoken about. And they found actually that those corn-based plastics tested positive for estrogenic activity more than any other plastic except polycarbonate. So I believe it was 91% of the time.
Wondering also about an email here, and we're getting several like this, from a listener named Bill who says, while the experts debate effects of BPA, aren't we in the meantime human guinea pigs? Better to impose a moratorium until the scientists figure it out? And Justin Teagarden, got to go to you again on this, because what you're saying is you guys have figured it out, pretty much. I mean, the regulatory agencies have figured it out, yeah.
Well, there's certainly a consistency in their reporting, but I'd like to make a different point here to kind of put a different context on this. I think all the people here on the phone and many of the people that are listening have expressed a concern about exposure to estrogens, that is non-estrogens that we don't typically find, that aren't produced by our body. And I just want to say that if we all agree that's the public health concern here, then the first question we need to ask is, what is the source of those estrogens in our environment that get into our blood that are most potent and potentially most problematic? And if you start with that so that you can focus on those and remove them, you have to begin asking the questions about the influence of soy products and other natural estrogens that we get from our food, which are have been shown to be just as potent, if not far more potent in most cases, than bisphenol A, for example. So if people have this concern, then the question is, where should we really be focused? Because if we're going to spend money on public health, then we want to have the biggest bang for the buck.
I want to bring another caller in, and that's you, Michael. Thanks for waiting. Join us.
Sure. I'm curious about how BPA is treated in Europe, where the chemical regulatory regime is one that requires that compounds be proven safe and places the burden on industry to produce that proof. So how does Europe handle this issue?
Meg Schwarzman?
There's actually a variation of laws among the different European countries because it's not something that has been regulated under REACH yet. And I want to correct a little bit the caller's perception of what REACH does, because although it demands that information be provided about volume of production and some basic toxicity testing, it only requires proof of safety for some very select group of particularly high-hazard chemicals, and BPA has not, at least yet, been designated as one of those chemicals.
And let me thank the
caller. May I weigh in?
Please. Linda Birnbaum.
So France has actually announced that it is going to ban BPA entirely beginning in 2015. This has set off somewhat of a fight in the European Union. But some European countries do ban BPA in infant products, as does the United States now.
So I want to take us back. This is Linda Birnbaum. I want to take us back a little bit to the human studies where we're seeing associations with BPA. Many of those studies are still kind of in their early stages. Many of them are measuring BPA in the same people where they're looking for an effect, which is not the best way to do an epidemiological study. You're much better taking samples and following what happens to the health of the person. We do have some of those studies, and they are suggestive of the same kind of effects we're seeing in some of the animal studies. I think we need to remember that the level of exposure, how much you eat or how much you drink, has to be higher for an animal to get the same internal dose as, for example, in a human. So we need to look at that. We also need to understand that there can be an extremely wide variability in sensitivity of people to the responses of something like BPA. And the other point I really want to make is BPA is not just an estrogen. In fact, it has other mechanisms of action that do not involve the same classical responses as our natural human hormone.
And yet, I'm thinking about the fact that a lot of this has to do with these studies, especially these epidemiological studies, with chemistry that's in the urine or the blood. And again, Meg Schwartzman keep hammering this point home. You can take the research to either side. A lot of that has to do with the fact that, well, again, if somebody drinks too much water, they can be harmed by it, right?
Sure. And I think it raises the point, you know, it always makes me ask, is there an alternative to going down this rabbit hole of dueling science? And I would say there are other questions that we can be asking. We can be asking the simple one of, is this chemical necessary in any given application? Or is there another way that we can achieve this function, maybe, you know, without the chemical? Are there some essential uses that we should continue while turning to safer alternatives in the majority of our uses? And while I think it's important to investigate the problems, I think we should be simultaneously looking at solutions. And that's something that as long as we're debating the science, we're just waiting on.
There's a tweet here from a listener named Io, and maybe Mariah Blake, you can shed some light on this. He wants to know, how pervasive are estrogenic compounds in all plastics, as bags for chips and cereal, bags for veggies at the grocery, and so forth?
We actually have something on our website called A Frightening Field Guide to Common Plastics, which includes the results of the one study that has been done on estrogenic activity in plastics generally, and that tells you what percentage of each type of plastic is tested estrogenic in these CERTICAM tests, so the cell-based tests, and what they're commonly found in. So, for example, PET water bottles tested positive for estrogenic activity in about 75% of cases. There's also been some scientists in Germany also tested this using a separate kind of test involving snails, mud snails, and they also found that PET was estrogenic. So PET is the kind of plastic that is most commonly used in water bottles and soda bottles.
Well, we're on, I think, the same topic here with the caller from Pleasanton. Henry, go ahead. You're on.
Yes. Just one point, Michael. Given that this is very controversial, that, you know, to say the least, there's a big part of the context that hasn't been discussed is what if, you know, plastics were widely banned or manufacturers were forced to, you know, remove a lot of plastics from the market, all these rules and regulations. What would be the implications for the food safety, you know, with using these materials in, you know, for purpose?
Yeah, the health implications of cutting back on plastics and food safety.
Do you mind if I say something?
Yeah, go ahead.
The thing is that in these tests that were done by this Georgetown University professor and this company called CERTICAM, they found that there are a number of plastics out there that do not have estrogenic activity. So the truth is that it's possible to manufacture plastic products that don't have this effect. And that don't have the potential health consequences of these chemicals.
Well, we've got a ban now on plastic water bottles in San Francisco, as I'm sure you're all aware.
Yes, this whole debate around the science is a way, I think, of avoiding action
in
many cases.
I think Mariah raises an interesting point, which is the sort of other business interests that we shouldn't ignore. So we hear a lot from the people who produce the chemical that's under attack. But there are other business interests like the chemical users, people who manufacture products using chemicals. They have different interests. They want safe chemicals. They don't want to endanger their workers. They want to be able to ensure their consumers that their products are safe. There's retailers who want to be able to do the same. And in fact, you know, Walmart pulled BPA-based baby bottles off their shelves in 2008, years before any regulatory action was taken. So these are business groups that are employing a different level of evidence.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about cash registers and BPA traces, and,
right, receipts.
The receipts and that come out of cash registers.
Well, this is Linda Birnbaum. I'd like to mention that. In fact, what's happened to the issue of thermal papers that have BPA on top is that that's being substituted now. BPA is being substituted with alternatives. Again, the issue we don't necessarily know, for example, whether the alternatives that are being used in thermal paper are safer than BPA.
And again, Linda Birnbaum is director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and National Toxicology Program. Let me go back to researcher Justin Teagarden. Actually, this is a little bit ad hominem here, but I want to get your response, Justin, to a web posting by one of our listeners, Jane, who says, Justin Teagarden is just a mouthpiece for the plastics industry. There's no question that BPA, bisphenol A, is harmful to human health in ways we are still discovering. There's a full discussion of endocrine disruptors, of which BPA is just one, in the book Our Stolen Future by Theo Colburn.
I'm not sure there's ever an appropriate response to an ad hominem attack. I mean, these are tactics that people use when they don't choose to talk about the science.
You know the Colburn book, though? Are you familiar with it?
I've never read it, but I'm certainly familiar with it, yeah.
Yeah, and many would probably say that's proof, and you would say what to that argument?
I don't think that's a particularly scientific piece of writing. I think it had an objective. I think in the case of EPA, as I've said before, my reliance is on the work that NIEHS is currently conducting with their collaborators and the research that they're funding with an academic group of people and with the conclusions of these other scientific panels. I mean, I think that, as I said before to some of the journalists that are online now, it becomes relatively easy to look out into the literature and rely on arguments from the past and selective citation to come up with a story or a particular argument. It's much more difficult to go through this stuff systematically and objectively and draw conclusions. And so I have to rely on that kind of process, and less so on Theo Colburn's book. As a scientist, that's just what we need to do.
Well, here's the listener.
Excuse me, this is Linda.
Yeah,
I just want to mention that the NIEHS, NTP, FDA studies are not yet available. They're not yet completed. So I think the jury on some of the animal studies is still out. But I do think that we need to at least look and consider the growing amount of epidemiological information. In other words, the observational studies we're seeing in people, which are supported by a lot of the studies that have been conducted, the more mechanistic studies that have been conducted in animal studies. I don't have any problem with the regulatory studies that have largely been conducted, but many of them don't ask the questions that are being asked by a lot of the grantee kind of stuff.
Well, here's a central question that I want to get to. Excuse me, the central question was tweeted by a listener. It's coming from a number of listeners. I'll just read the tweet here. I understand there may be potential health effects because of BPA, but no one has spoken about what those effects actually would be.
Okay, so there's a wide range of effects. I think our greatest concern is for the effects that occurred during early life exposure. That could be in utero or during the infantile period, which are times in your life where you were extremely susceptible to chemical effects. There are other, and some of those effects are related to the developing nervous system, can lead to behavioral effects.
There have been links to ADD, for example, correct?
There have been
a suggestion or hypothesis.
A hypothesis. I think certainly ADHD, there's the possibility. I think there are other things we just don't know because the studies are still in their early stages. I think there's suggestion of effects associated with obesity in children. There have been a number of studies that have shown associations there in people, in children, and there is data in the animal literature and in the mechanistic cell culture studies that suggest an effect on that. There are now some suggestions from animal data of a possible carcinogenic response, in other words, causing cancer in certain tissues that you wouldn't see quickly. You're going to have to wait a long time to see those kinds of effects.
Again, doesn't it come back, Linda Birnbaum, to dosage? I mean,
if I could make a point here, Linda and I agree on many of these points. And I think both of us are trying to suggest that there's more information coming out soon from some very well-designed studies that we'll rely on those and the regulatory process. But with regard to exposure, and Linda is pointing out some connections between epidemiological findings and effects in laboratories, both in animals and cell cultures. But one of the standards that I personally would choose to hold those relationships to is whether or not the dose is experienced in the cells or anywhere near those in humans. So, for example, if you see effects in humans in an epidemiology study, and you see something in a cell culture study that suggests a relationship, a similar effect, but if those effects occur at doses that are 100,000 times higher than a human cell will ever see, I'm not sure that in my mind that is clear evidence that of, for example, a mechanism or clear evidence of a consistency between laboratory systems and epidemiologies. That is a standard, I think, that regulatory review panels will eventually hold these data to or should.
Boy, we're getting questions here from listeners that just make things even more murky. For example, looking at an email from Dave from up in Hillsburg who asks, isn't it true that any glass jars containing anything acidic have plastic-lined lids? Is this potential source of BPA? I mean, you know, we're talking about cash register receipts and, I mean, the range of things that have BPA or that may be tainted by BPA. And Serena asks, assuming the accusations of BPA do harm humans are true, do any of your guests have statistics about whether the plastic is safer when it's newer or older? That is, does the plastic break down more in older bottles, sippy cups, or are those safer because the initial off-gassing has already taken place? Meg Schwarzman?
On that, there have been some studies that have been done that showing, suggesting that as the plastic gets older, it gets, you know, you get cracks and so on, and then there you may have more leakage of that, as well as leakage can relate to the temperature. So at higher temperatures, you might have more leakage.
Meg, you want to add something here?
Well, it's just one of the reasons that people really suggest not microwaving things in plastic and also not putting them in the dishwasher.
Well, we'll continue to monitor this obviously controversial ongoing debate about BPA. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated in the evening. We're going to talk next hour about Beasts, the new book by Jeffrey Mason, animal rights advocate. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Jack Detch, Marisa Endicott, Maryam Jamil, Hannah Rose Levy, Audrey Gertz, and Daniel Radin. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.